Welcome to Little Atoms on Resonance 104.4 FM, a live talk show about ideas and culture, with an emphasis on ideas of the Enlightenment.
Little Atoms is presented by Neil Denny, Padraig Reedy, Richard Sanderson and Becky Hogg, as well as regular guest presenters.
Little Atoms actively promotes science, freedom of expression, scepticism and secular humanism.
Our guests bring ideas that are challenging, sometimes controversial, often polemical, but always interesting.
Good evening, welcome to another edition of Little Atoms, tonight with me Neil Denny, and I'm talking to Professor Lisa Randall. Lisa Randall studies theoretical particle physics and cosmology at Harvard University. Randall's studies have made her among the most cited and influential theoretical physicists. She has also had a public presence through her writing, lectures and radio and TV appearances. Her book Warped Passages, Unravelling the Mysteries of the Universe's Hidden Dimensions, was included in the New York Times' 100 Notable Books of 2005. Randall has received numerous awards and honours for her scientific endeavours. She is a member of the National Academy of Sciences, the American Philosophical Society, and the American Academy of Arts and Sciences. On tonight's show, we'll be talking about Lisa's latest book, which is Knocking on Heaven's Door, How Physics and Scientific Thinking Illuminate the Universe and the Modern World. So I'm talking to Lisa Randall. Lisa, thanks for speaking to Little Atoms today.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to talk to you.
So we're going to be talking about your book, Knocking on Heaven's Door. It sets out to detail the current state of particle physics and cosmology, but it also contains a more sort of general exposition of the importance of the scientific method and a scientific mindset. So why did you decide to include the latter?
Well, actually, that was actually where my book started. I really wanted to not to describe the importance of scientific thinking, but also really describe what it is. I think there's a lot of misconceptions about science, and it leads to debates and people not fully understanding and appreciating science, but also not understanding how the scientific method can apply in the world. And here in America, you see a lot of very logical decisions, a lot of very funny debates, both about science and about the affairs today. And there were just so many interesting questions and comments I had after writing my first book, War Passages, that I really wanted to talk not just about the physics itself, but the context for the physics. And I think it's just, if you dive right into the world of elementary particles, it's very hard to see how that connects to the science we see today. And I really wanted to make those connections clear, both to illuminate the science and to illuminate what's going on in the world. In fact, the subtitle of the book is How Physics and Scientific Thinking Illuminate the Universe and the Modern World. And the title refers to how we do science. We build on what we know and move forward and go to those edges. And we often describe science as just sort of replacing things. And I want to describe how science really is a systematic way of advancing our ideas.
You mentioned early on in the book that it's not just the lay public that confuses the idea of the scientific method. There's actually various different interpretations within science itself, really.
Well, I think that's right. I think people don't always understand when one thing can affect another, which is part of what science systematically tells us, how much uncertainty is acceptable for any given result with any given degree of accuracy and measurements, how well we have to know something in order to make a prediction we can trust and keep. So there's just many issues that come up in the context of science, and I really wanted to explain those, what it means to be right and wrong, how scientific ideas advance and build on each other, the role of scale, the role of uncertainty, for example.
Could we perhaps take a few moments just to talk a little bit then about how that scientific method developed?
Well, you know, I thought it would be fun to share. I had taken a trip to Italy, to Padua, in fact, to attend a scientific conference. And also I was offered the honor of getting the key to the city, which was a lot of fun. But in the process, I learned a lot about Galileo. It happened to be the 400th anniversary of his work, which he had done, actually, in Padua. So there was an exhibit which actually illuminated a lot of what had happened at that time to really change the nature of science. The idea that observations didn't have to be directly with your eyes. It was acceptable to look through lenses. That sounds, of course, not very radical to us today. I mean, everyone wears glasses. But at the time, it was a radical idea that there should be some intermediary between your eyes and what you see. And, of course, today we've advanced in that idea in many ways where we have lots of indirect measurements. And people have the same questioning today about those indirect measurements that they did back then. So that was interesting insight. The idea that you can make experiments, which are not just observations, artificial situations to try to elucidate some principle or idea. The role of scale. Galileo also not only had a telescope, but he had a microscope. He looked at big and small, and he thought about how things change when they go to different sizes. He also did thought experiments, tried to imagine what would happen in certain circumstances, even if he wasn't actually doing an experiment itself. So there were just lots of ways in which Galileo's insights prevailed. And he also understood the role of experiments, not just to verify ideas, but to rule them out sometimes. And so the idea that we can systematically build our knowledge was rooted in large part both in Galileo and other people at his time, during his time period.
In terms of some of the higher theoretical physics and cosmology ideas that you cover, you touch on things like string or M theory and Higgs field and dark matter. Why do you think it's important for the public to have at least some grasp of these concepts?
So it's funny, because I actually never say that they have to know these concepts. What I do think people have to know is how to think scientifically. I think that would just make us make better decisions. But what I do think is that if people are interested in knowing these amazing things about what can underlie our universe, they should have a way of finding out about it. So I'm not writing my book and telling people you have to read it, but I think, at least the parts about physics. But I do think that if people are interested in physics, they should have a way to be able to get at it. And science has advanced to a point where unless some people make the effort to explain it, it's just very hard to grasp. I mean, it is amazing material about the way the world works. It's, of course, fascinating to know what is the nature of the universe we live in, what is the nature of matter. But if you want to ignore it and not care about it, that's your prerogative.
So the book talks about particle physics and cosmology, two areas of science that deal with the extremely small and the extremely large. That in itself is one way that it's difficult for a layperson to grasp these concepts because of the terms of scale. Most human minds, I imagine quite a lot of scientists, also struggle with the grasping the unimaginably small and large. So how do we deal with this?
Well, as you probably know, that is one of the issues I really do deal with, and that's just what scale means and what's going on at different scales and how the science of one scale matches on to what's going on at the science of another scale. I mean, we always say that it's unimaginably or unconceived, but the fact is we are imagining it and we are conceiving of it. We're not seeing it. It's not intuitive. It's not a human scale. It's not the scales we encounter in our everyday lives. So we need a new language, a new way of thinking about it. But that doesn't mean that it doesn't exist. It doesn't mean we can't have ways of making advances. I mean, for us, once we're in that world, and by us, I mean physicists, once we're in that world, that is how we're thinking about things. Once you know those rules and are familiar with them, it does become the way that world works. But what you have to recognize, it's a very different world in the sense that it's operating at a very different scale. So you shouldn't expect it necessarily behaves the way matter behaves. I mean, we have a tabletop. It doesn't look like it's made up of atoms, but underneath it is. And those atoms are mostly empty space. It's an amazing fact that most of every solid matter is empty space. So it doesn't mean that that's how it's going to look to us today, but once you know that, you can work with those concepts and see what it means and the implications.
Well, it could be said that part of the goal of modern theoretical physics and cosmology is to somehow reunite these worlds of the small and large from the point where, if we go back to, say, the beginnings of quantum theory, we could describe as the point where they sort of diverged. Let's have a look about, before we get on to look at some of the ideas, where the sort of desire to find a theory of everything comes from.
Well, again, that isn't my focus. If you notice, I'm focusing on what we're learning by experiment, how we're making advances. When I talk about knocking on heaven's door, I'm talking about going right beyond where we are today. What is it that we're going to learn from experiments and theory? I do talk about these theoretical ideas. Some of them have implications for how we think about things. But a very important idea is an effective theory idea. So it could be that what underlies matter could be strings, it could be particles, but if those strings are 16 orders of magnitude too small to observe, you can't tell the difference between a point particle and a string. And that's a really important notion, that these ideas can underlie what we see, and they get a lot of attention. But they're not all that's happening in physics. A lot of what's happening in physics has to do with the measurements being made today, finding out about the matter we know about. What are elementary particles made of? Where do they get their masses? What is the nature of the underlying forces? What is the nature of space? We might be able to answer a question about the nature of space. People focus on this question of unifying gravity and quantum mechanics, some physicists do, but that is certainly not all that we do. And in fact, it's pretty much irrelevant to what's going on in experiments today. And this is an exciting time because of the experiments, because of the Large Hadron Collider, because of the searches for dark matter. We'll be making advances in theory as well. But I think right now it's very exciting to focus on the experimental developments and how those interface with theory. It's not just experiments. It's not just hardware. There's some really interesting theoretical ideas that are being tested at these experiments, and those are what I'd like to focus on.
So you mentioned the LHC, the Large Hadron Collider, and its development and the experiments that are going on there are central to the book. I mean, it's probably fair to say that for a long time, ideas of the sort of theoretical ideas, particularly of physics, have been light years ahead of what experiments have been able to be done by sort of experimental scientists. So to what extent is the LHC going to bridge that gap?
Well, it's going to tell us the way forward in the sense of we have very definite questions about what's called the standard model of particle physics that tells us about matter's most basic elements and their interactions. And we have questions about it, though. It relies on a sort of an unsturdy foundation. The question is, where do elementary particles acquire their masses, and why do they have the masses they do? If you just followed what the theory leads you to, you would expect those masses to be many times bigger than they are. Another way of phrasing the question is, why is gravity acting on these elementary particles so weak compared to the other fundamental forces? These are questions we really have a chance of answering. They're questions we've had for the last few decades. There's many amazing theoretical ideas extending the symmetries of space, the symmetry that says, for example, physics looks the same in every direction, into the quantum regime, or ideas even about having an extra dimension of space or a warped extra dimension of space, a very curved space beyond the three dimensions that we observe. So there are some pretty fascinating theoretical concepts that are being tested even as we learn about these issues. And this year could be an exciting year to learn more about this particle called the Higgs boson that tells how elementary particles acquire their masses. So there's a lot of theoretical questions that will at least know whether we're on the right track, which is important.
So you mentioned the Higgs boson, and this is, you know, probably the area of research that people will be most familiar with in terms of the Large Hadron Collider. So let's perhaps talk a little bit about what does the Large Hadron Collider do in terms of how it's going to find if the Higgs boson exists.
Well, first of all, although people might be familiar, they don't always know exactly what the Higgs boson is.
No, that's a good point.
So let's first review what it is, and then we'll understand how you can find it. So there's something called the Higgs mechanism, named after the physicist Peter Higgs, and it has to do with how elementary particles get their masses. You might think that might sound bizarre, because you might think, well, you could have masses from the very beginning. But the fact is, if particles had masses from the beginning, you would make nonsensical predictions, probabilities greater than one, at relatively low energies. So we know that theory isn't right. So the Higgs mechanism says that particles acquire their mass in some sense because the vacuum, the state of empty space with no actual matter in it, is in some sense contains a charge, not an electric charge, but some sort of charge with which particles bounce off. The heavier particles bounce off more, they interact more. Lighter particles interact less, and that's the way they acquire their masses. Now, that idea seems to work. It doesn't give the silly predictions that I mentioned earlier, and particles do get masses. But the question is it right? And also, if there is this charge throughout space, throughout the vacuum, how did it get there? What is it that distributed it there? And that involves looking for actual particles, actual matter, that can somehow sprinkle this charge or sprinkle this matter throughout. And the question is then, can we find that matter? What is it? The simplest implementation of the Higgs mechanism involves a particle called the Higgs boson, the Higgs particle. And we know a lot about that particle because it interacts the most with heavy particles. It interacts the least with light particles. So we actually know its interactions. We don't yet know its mass, which is why there's uncertainty when we're looking for it. But we do know what to look for if we assume the Higgs boson has any particular mass. And that's what experiments are doing today. They assume the Higgs boson has mass, and they say, can we find it? And so by doing that, they've put limits. There are certain masses that are no longer allowed, and there are certain masses that perhaps are the most interesting that have not yet been tested. So the Higgs boson is just, keep in mind though, it's just one possible way that we could implement the Higgs mechanism, but it's certainly the simplest target to look for, and it's what they're looking for.
But the LHC will, I mean, even if it proves that the Higgs boson doesn't exist and this is wrong, I mean, that's clearly still a significant finding for the Large Hadron Collider.
I mean, you know, it's funny. I talked to my physicist colleagues, and they're like, that would be so exciting if we didn't find the Higgs boson. Like, I don't think the rest of the world would understand how exciting that is. So it's important to know whether or not it's there.
You're listening to Little Atoms, tonight with me, Neil Denny, and I'm talking to Professor Lisa Randall about her book, Knocking on Heaven's Door, How Physics and Scientific Thinking Illuminate the Universe and the Modern World.
Well, it's interesting in the way that perhaps a lot of the reporting of the development of the Large Hadron Collider has been talking about it's being built perhaps to find this thing, and therefore if it doesn't find it, if there's an announcement that it doesn't exist, that could in some ways be sort of reported as a bad thing. There has been a huge amount of public interest in the Large Hadron Collider, possibly on one side because of the huge amount of money it's cost. And I wonder if in some ways this can perhaps be a burden.
Well, look, when I write my book, I try to be very clear about what it can and cannot do and what we're looking for and what it means. I don't just say it's looking for the Higgs boson. I mean, some people might say that. It's a simplification that sounds easy to convey to the public. But in some ways, that might be the least interesting part of what we're finding. These questions about the nature of space and what it is that controls the weakness of gravity could be the more fascinating. The thing about the Higgs boson is that it's light, so it's very likely that it's accessible even at the energies the Large Hadron Collider is running at now. It's only running at half energy, don't forget. The other things might be heavier and harder to find. So one of the reasons people focus on the Higgs boson is because of its accessibility in the sense of being the lightest of the new particles that we're fairly certain should be there. Something should be there. But it's certainly not the only thing we're looking for, and it's certainly not the only way the Higgs mechanism can be implemented. So, that is the advantage of a book over a, two-paragraph newspaper.
Sure.
That you can really explain what we're really doing. So I don't think that way of being sold is necessarily correct.
Do you think there's also perhaps an issue in the way that things are reported? I mean, just very recently there was this perhaps premature announcement about photons moving perhaps faster than the speed of light, which now as all sort of scientists not involved in the experiment are saying, well, this isn't going to turn out to be true.
Well, I would say that it was maybe a little bit misrepresented in the sense that I think they did the right thing. They had this result. They did a very careful measurement, and they were getting an answer that I would say most of the physicists there didn't believe themselves, and they wanted to know what they're doing wrong. So why isn't this result coming out right? So they put it out so that the physics community could investigate.
Which is how science works.
Where the measurement might have gone wrong? Could other people try to do a similar experiment? Is there a way they can modify their experiment to test it better? So I don't think that was necessarily a wrong thing. I think maybe putting it on the public and saying things like Einstein's theory is about to be overturned was misleading. Because even if the result turned out to be right, which as I don't think it will, it doesn't overturn Einstein's theory. It says that it has limitations. It says that it's based on assumptions that are, in the end, only approximations, which is often the case for science. I mean, Einstein's theory has worked. It's made many successful predictions. In just the same way Newton's laws still are true, even though there could be underlying theories such as quantum mechanics or relativity, it doesn't mean Newton's laws are wrong. Newton's laws are still used all over the place to make predictions, to throw a ball or to send a man to the moon. So you have to keep that in mind. The theories, if they're not overturned so much as you find the limitations and then you move on. That's the role of uncertainty. I mean, we haven't tested Einstein's theory to arbitrary accuracy, so it makes sense to keep testing and seeing can we advance on where we are today.
Before we move on from the LHC, we're talking here about the Higgs boson as the sort of key to discovering why everything, but particularly particles, have mass. All particles have different masses, and it's also interesting to try and look into why that might be. And you talk about something called the hierarchy problem. Can you perhaps give us a little overview of what that is?
Well, there's two different questions here, just to be clear.
Mm-hmm.
One is, why did all the individual particles have somewhat different masses? And then there's the question of, why are the masses so whoppingly different from the highest mass scale we know about, the scale associated with gravity? In other words, why are particles so light that gravity is a weak force? If they were 16 orders of magnitude heavier, their forces would be comparable. The force of gravity would be comparable to the other forces we know about, such as electromagnetism. But the fact is, it's much, much smaller force. So why is that? Why is there this hierarchy of masses, which is equivalent to the hierarchy of forces, that some gravity is so much weaker than the other forces? And that's the question I was referring to earlier. The question not just of why elementary particles get mass through the Higgs mechanism, but why those masses are what they are. And can we understand why gravity is so weak compared to the other elementary forces.
This problem is something you've actually worked on the theoretical side. So can you give us a little flavor of that?
Well, there's many fascinating ideas for what it could be. One is the idea called supersymmetry, which is the idea that there's an underlying symmetry that actually doubles the particle spectrum. Pairs particles we know about with sort of quantum mechanical counterparts. And we're looking for those counterparts now in experiments. The other thing that I've worked on has to do with an extra dimension of space. The idea that there could be an extra dimension and gravity could be strong elsewhere, but weak where we are. In fact, Raman Sundran and I came up with a theory where that happened automatically. We weren't actually looking for that. It's just if we had this extra dimension of space, not the three we know about, but one extra dimension of space, additional dimension, we found that gravity could vary very quickly, so that it's very natural for gravity to be much weaker here if we're not where gravity is concentrated. It's sort of localized. In fact, what happens in the space is really fascinating. You find that space itself gets rescaled. If you think about space in terms of the ruler with which you measure it, that ruler is changing its scale exponentially as you go across the dimension. And masses also change. So it's actually very natural. The question I asked earlier, why are masses so light, is very naturally answered in this scenario. And what's amazing is that even though it sounds like maybe a kooky idea, I mean, there are obviously good theoretical reasons to think about this, but it's also something that will be tested at the Large Hadron Collider. We will actually have some idea if it's right by going out and doing experiments, which they're doing today, to look for particles that travel in the extra dimension.
Okay, well, we're quickly running out of time. We haven't really touched on developments in cosmology, which form another part of the book, but we'll leave that for now, because I'd like to talk about... There's a scene right at the beginning of the book where you're testifying in the House Committee for Science and Technology, talking about, basically, the importance of pure scientific research. It's often said that nowadays the position of science in America is precarious. I mean, to what extent is that true? We've been talking about the Large Hadron Collider, and the Large Hadron Collider has just superseded the Tevatron at Fermilab as being the sort of world's preeminent collider.
I think that the U.S. has a trouble making commitment to long-term projects right now. They are expensive, but they're not so expensive compared to the overall size of our budget.
Sure.
And sometimes we miss how important science is, and basic science in particular. It's not that you can say, if we do this, this will be the consequence. But, of course, every time we've done major scientific advances, major advances in society have come about with it. Some of it is just because people are interested in science and because education benefits and people, students want to study it. But others are just side benefits that we don't anticipate. We certainly don't anticipate benefits from the basic science, and they don't necessarily happen immediately. But when electricity was discovered, no one knew it would change the face of the globe. Quantum mechanics helped develop the semiconductor industry, which gave us the electronics industry. CERN actually developed the World Wide Web. They wanted to have experimenters talk to each other from different nations in an easy way. So we often do get big advances, even if when we can't anticipate them. But we certainly get a better educated, more motivated public.
You look in the book at the science-religion debate, and you know, particularly the difficulty of squaring a sort of materialist worldview with a religious worldview. And again, this is not something that's so apparent to us in the UK as is in the United States. So tell us a little bit about what it's like to be a theoretical physicist working in that climate.
Well, so first of all, I just want to say when I compare it to the materialist view, I mean, when we're comparing religion, I mean religion as in a deity or spiritual force that really comes in and
impacts
our world, whether it's the rotation of the planets or the way I'm thinking about something or making moral choices. There really is a distinction. But I do also have a chapter about why do we care. And I think it's what we're finding is not just a debate between religion and science, but it really, at this point, I think it's almost turning into a debate over how much we trust rational scientific thinking. And that is a really major issue, I would say. In terms of the research I'm doing, it's not necessarily coming up. But in terms of just watching policy debates and watching people talk about these things, I think it is important that people understand how to go about thinking about these issues and why it's so valuable, what we've learned from it. And that's one of the reasons I want to clarify what science is. Sometimes science gets blamed because they think of it as a set of predictions. a set of predictions, and then they just go ahead and derive some simple consequences. But it's more than that. It's understanding the questions. It's understanding the uncertainties. It's understanding how much we trust results. And I think that that is really important in this society. I mean, we tend to associate, America likes to associate sort of goodness with religious beliefs, but that's not true. I mean, there's lots of good people who really want good things that aren't necessarily religious. And I think it's important to recognize that scientific thinking, especially with the big problems we face today, it's so important so that we can actually make advances and really hope to solve them.
I've been talking to Professor Lisa Randall about her book, Knocking on Heaven's Door, How Physics and Scientific Thinking Illuminate the Universe and the Modern World, and that's out now from Bodley Head. So Lisa, thank you for speaking to Little Atoms today.
Thank you very much.
Okay, before we finish this evening, I just want to tell you about the next Little Atoms live event, which is taking place at the Bishopsgate Institute on Tuesday the 15th of November at 7:30. The event is called Information Dissemination in the New Media Age. With rapidly developing new media and modes of mass communication, we continuously absorb information as well as giving information about ourselves. From political leaks to Twitter, mobile location finders to credit card use, information is collected. The beneficiaries are clear, with possible political advantages, marketing opportunities, subliminal advertising and surveillance, as well as greater access to information for all of us. Who controls what information is circulated and to whom? And to what extent does censorship conflict with freedom of information or overlap with data protection and privacy? Speaking on this subject are the journalist and writer Heather Brook, Professor Brian Cathcart of Kingston University, and Peter Barron of Google. And the event is chaired by Little Atoms' own Becky Hogg. Hope to see some of you there.
You've been listening to Little Atoms. You can find details of upcoming guests at our website, littleatoms.com. The Little Atoms podcast is available on iTunes. Thanks for listening.